processes and scheduling. So, I have an application. Its image has been loaded in memory. And I've said that we're going to execute its instructions, but I've kind of waved my hands about the mechanism. There's also the issue that we actually want to do lots of these applications, and we want it to appear that we're doing them all at once. In fact, we're not. The processor is a lot faster than your fingers, so what we'll do in order to create the appearance, barring actually having more than one processor, what we'll do to create the appearance of doing things in parallel is we'll do a little bit of one thing, and then a little bit of the next thing, a little bit of the thing after that, and we'll switch so fast between them that you can't tell that they're not actually all running at the same time. Okay. So basically, this is like, have you ever seen a tachistoscope, or have you seen a movie of them doing flash tests on people's eyes, where they'll flash an image on the screen, and the image will go away, and the question is, how much of the image do you remember? And, you know, and according to how fast I leave the image on the screen and how good your memory is, you'll remember more or less. There's even a perverse effect that there's some weird range here where if I show the image for less time, you actually remember more. And then there's a threshold below that where you remember less even. It's like there's kind of a flashbulb effect, right? And your brain gets an after image that it's able to watch for some period of time after the real image has gone away. Well, or a movie, right? You go to the movie theater, it looks like the picture's moving. Obviously, the picture ain't moving. Okay, the movie was framed at 60 frames a second or something like that, and that turns out to be fast enough that your eye fills in the gaps. If you go to a movie and you watch the movie and you blink your eyes fast enough, the movie will look jerky, and that's because, in fact, it's not a continuous motion picture. It's doing time sharing. In fact, that's a reasonable metric for how fast we have to do things. Okay? If we can get every application you can actually see 60 times a second, we're done. Your eye will lie to you, and we've now accomplished our goal, which is to make everything look like it ran at the same time. And we can do it a lot faster than 60 times a second. Now, the catch is that if we're going to multiplex the processor in this way, right, we're going to run around all these applications, we have, in the hardware, I think I said this before, but in case I didn't, let me say it again, that until further notice, in this class, I am not going to consider multiprocessors. There are lots of issues with multiprocessors we're going to need to consider. Some of them are tricky, but a lot of this stuff, you have to go back and revisit and revise to deal with multiprocessor issues, and let's get the concept settled first. So under that assumption, we have one CPU, and we have a bunch of apps that we want to run. And we basically need to put one app on the CPU, run it a little bit, get it off. Next app on the CPU, run it a little bit, get it off. In order to do this, we have to have an answer to the question, hey, when I kick your application off the CPU, where do I put its registers? We're going to need a save area. Pretty soon we're going to say, gosh, just flipping the registers in and out of the processor, that's not really all of the context that I need for your application. Your application has some files of it. It holds descriptors to those files. So there's some state that is, when I'm running your application, there's state that's not in the processor exactly, but it is associated with your application. And when I switch from one application to another, I have to make sure that this state, when you go to do a file access, that I don't use somebody else's file descriptors to do it. Okay? So, there's a descriptor table. And just as a forward reference to something that I'm not going to get to until tomorrow, It's not the actual table we're going to store here. It's a pointer to the table, and I'll explain more in a second, in tomorrow. What else? Well, depending on the operating system, there may be other state that's maintained for the application that's defined by the operating system. So in the POSIX case, there is signal handling state. There is a current working directory. There's a current root directory. And these are actually descriptors at the level of the operating system. We'll get to descriptors. So, one way to think about this is we have two categories of things here, right? We have state that's dictated by the hardware architecture, that's the same area. And then we have state that's dictated by the operating system, all of which is, in effect, either directly or by reference, some kind of a list of resources. And in some sense, the same area also encapsulates a resource. So it encapsulates a logical CPU. And let me be a little careful, because while there are a few resources in the process, mostly it's not the resources themselves, it's references to the resource. So your file descriptor table, that's not a table of files. It is, in effect, a table of pointers to files, descriptors to files. The fact that you possess those descriptors tells us that you have some authority over the associated resource, the ability to read and write. Well, depending on how you open it. So actually, ignoring things like signal state, which really are directly resources in the process, think of the signal state as being stored in extra registers that aren't provided by the hardware, so the software is simulating. But as to the rest of this, really, what we're defining with the rest of this stuff is one or more namespaces that we're going to do references against. So what do I mean by namespace? It's an indexing mechanism. When you do a write call, not the fwrite provided by libc, but the write call that's at the system call layer boundary in POSIX, what's the first argument to the write call? Does anybody here not call, read, or write? Yeah, okay. Perfectly reasonable. Okay. Yeah.
But it's the same as fwrite, but it's the file name.
It's not the same as fwrite. I can see I've got to put Unix systems programming back in the requirements list. Okay. What? It's a file descriptor. If you go look at the man page, right, you'll see that the man page says something like this. By the way, I almost invariably get the length and the buffer swap. That's why the man page is there, so that I can look it up every time I type right. Now, you should understand this FD part in the read call is horribly misnamed. It is absolutely not a file descriptor. The file descriptor is in the kernel. What that is the name of the file descriptor. It's a number, it's an index. So when you say read 3 4096 MyBuff, what you're saying is that 3 is go into my file table, find the third descriptor, and do the descriptor specific read operation on that descriptor. So contrary to what the man page tells you, this is not a file descriptor, this is a file descriptor name. Whenever you hear name, you want to be thinking namespace, because names don't have intrinsic meaning. Names have meaning that's assigned to them by a namespace. A namespace is just a lookup table. It's a mapping. May or may not be a table. So if we were going to do this in the terminology of denotational semantics, what we would say is do a read on the thing denoted by 3. And put the result into MyBuff. Right? This 3 is meaningless without knowing the context in which it's interpreted, namely what file table this reference is relevant to. Just like a virtual address is meaningless without knowing the mapping table that it traverses. So a mapping table is also namespace. All right. I'm sequestering the save area part of all this for a reason that I'll get to tomorrow. Well, I think. All of this stuff collectively, that's a process. A process forms an association between some register state and some resources and an address state. So there are a couple of other resources I need to put in here. We're not going to run instructions if we don't tell you what address space we're running them from. So the process has to tell me that. And a schedule. And so actually, most of what we need to talk about this week is not the process, it's the scheduling part.
Just to make sure, when you say address space, you mean page directory?
Strictly speaking, no. Strictly speaking, what this address space is a pointer to the region list associated with this process. We're going to build the address space from that. But ultimately, by implication, the answer is yes, a pointer to the page directory. But the page directory is really a cache. The state of the page tables, what gets put in them, is really a cache of what's in your region list. All right, the idea that I would need to have some resources to run the program, that's not so surprising. The program's going to do some operations, and I need to know what they need. In fact, by the way, on some operating systems, there's another table, which is the system call table. So Linux has a personality call. Whether Linux has personality is very debatable, but it has a personality call. And what this personality call determines is the mapping from system call numbers to functions that implement system calls within the kernel. So when you do this read call, right, this is a C library thing. This turns into an assembly language stub. The assembly language stub basically takes those arguments and it puts them, it takes the arguments which are the 3, the 4096, and the address of MyBuff. And it actually puts one more argument in place, which is the system call number. And for every system call in the, well, for every Let me finish the statement, and then I'll follow up. For every system call in section 2 of the Unix man page, there is an assigned system call number. And actually, that assembly stub basically puts that number in a register, and it issues a track instruction. It issues the same track instruction for all system calls, ignoring issues of backwards compatibility. Linux has like 4 of these. When you get into the kernel, the way you discover what system call was invoked is you look at the value in the system call register. And it's known which register this is by convention of how the interface is specified at the binary level. Well, in fact, if you look, you'll discover that Linux has modules that support other systems. Until very recently, it had a Xenix compatibility mode. They're now talking about taking it up, and they've already done so. Xenix is a legacy 286 Unix version that grew up into a legacy 386 Unix version. And it was developed in a different place, and the assignment between system calls and numbers was actually not the same for Xenix as it is for Linux. So if you say in Linux, I want to run some process in the Xenix mode, what Linux does is it changes the system call table. And it simply implements both. Interesting thing to note there, and we'll come back to it late in the course, there's another thing you could do. You could say, well, maybe the kernel shouldn't implement system calls at all. Maybe it should turn them into messages and send them to somebody else. And we'll come back to that thought in a lot of weeks. So, what a process does is it serves to provide an association between an address space and a processor and some resources. And so this register save area stuff, that's the logical CPU. Another way to look at this logical CPU thing is it's a set of register state plus some OS defined state that we're bolting onto the side of this processor. So we're using the operating system to form an extended processor, some of whose state is managed in software rather than hardware. And that's a little weird. Let me make it a little weirder. That thing that you thought was hardware is, in fact, an extended processor, some of whose state is really hardware and some of whose state is managed in microcode, which is also known as software. If you're running a Transnetta processor, a CRUSO, that chip doesn't run penny instructions. It runs an interpreter, which runs penny instructions. You can't tell. Well, you can't, but unless you really go looking, you can't tell. All right, so what about this schedule part? Well, I need this illusion that I'm running all these processes at the same time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take one logical CPU, I'm going to put it on the real CPU for a little while, then I'm going to kick it off, I'm going to go on to the next one, and so forth. There are a bunch of policies I could have for how to do that. The first one is called, and the simplest one is called round robin. So round robin says, works like this. I have some list of processes that are candidates to run. We'll talk about why they might not be candidates to run pretty soon, but I have some subset of all of my processes that are candidates to run. Let me give you a hint. If I do a read and the disk is going to have to do a 15 millisecond operation, there's no point trying to run me, and I'm waiting for the answer. There's no point trying to run me until the answer comes back. So that process is going to become what's called blocked. And if it's blocked, it's not a candidate to run. So in round robin, what we say is, hey, we're just gonna go around the block in circles. And we're gonna run each process for a little bit of time, and then we're gonna move on to the next process. How long? Well, that's something called the quanta. And historically, the magic number for quanta would have been 10 milliseconds. That number has been going steadily down. Anybody have an idea why we want it to be 10 milliseconds? Why would I move the number up? Never mind what the number is for a minute. What would motivate me to use a longer quanta? Or what would stop me from using a longer quanta? What would happen if I made the quanta 10 seconds? What would you see? You'd notice that the processes really didn't look like they were running at the same time, right? Turns out you wouldn't, but it's plausible. There would be a few processes where you would notice. What would motivate me to make the quanta shorter?
The
more processes I have, the shorter the quanta has to get in order for this simultaneity illusion to be preserved. Are there other factors that would say, hey, above this point, there's no point raising the quanta length? What else might happen? So, I've said there are two reasons why I'm going to stop running the process. One is the quanta runs out, and the other is it blocks. So, might it be the case that there is some quanta where making the quanta bigger won't help? And if so, why would that be? That would be an argument for not making the quanta too small. If context switches are expensive, so yes, if I took my quanta down to a nanosecond, what would happen? Yeah, I agree. It's crazy, but actually, it's often a useful thought experiment to say, let's as a mental exercise, let's do something ridiculously extreme. Oh, right, there's a really good reason not to do that, and then you back off, right? So if I took it down to a nanosecond, what would happen? Not much, right? You'd get a quarter of an instruction executed, right? And the clock would go up and say, "Oh, you're done." The processor would say, "Oh shit, I can't complete this instruction in one quarter of the instruction time. I better not do anything." And your machine will spend all its time going from processor to processor to processor to processor to processor. Process, excuse me. How many of you have seen The King and I? Right, this is the bit about going from bee to bee to bee to bee to bee, right? The flower doesn't go around the bees. Never mind. Referenced about 30 years out of date. So you don't want to make the quanta ridiculously too small. Good. On the other hand, as long as the process is actually making progress, and you don't have a compelling reason to do something else, there's no reason to cut it off at the knees. The reason to cut it short is, at some point, you just got too much to do, and you lose the simultaneity. So there's some low threshold where below this, you're not going to get enough work done to have it be worthwhile. And there's another threshold where above this, you're going to lose the illusion of simultaneity. Are there any other interesting thresholds here? What would happen if I took the quanta? What would really happen? So the intuition that I would lose simultaneity turns out to be wrong. What would really happen if I took the quanta and I made it an hour? Would I lose the appearance of simultaneity? Let's assume I have no programs that are executing infinite loops. If you're a Java programmer, you have lots of those, but we'll just leave that out of this, right? What would happen if I made the quantity an hour? The quanta an hour?
You could only freeze the stuff in one program.
No, it would not freeze from one program. What would really happen? That would happen if I were running it through loops, yeah.
It would be something more like 15 seconds is the process of block.
15 seconds? You think it's that long?
15 milliseconds.
I'm guessing it's closer to 0.15 milliseconds. What kinds of things does your process block for? Every time it wants input, it has to wait for it, right? Every time it's waiting for a keystroke. You were a very slow peripheral, my friends. You're much slower than this drive. Every time it's waiting for a disk block. Therefore, every time it's waiting for a piece of a file, every time it's waiting for a network packet, given modern processor speeds, do you spend most of your time computing or most of your time waiting?
Waiting.
So if I set the quanta up to an hour, and you didn't have an infinite loop running, probably you would never notice. I'm tempted to make this a project assignment. Now, of course, if you did turn out to have some compute-bound process, you would feel some pain. Statistically, such processes are not observed in the wild. There are a few national laboratories where if you wish to play with simulating certain classes of devices, you can do very compute-intensive jobs. However, you need a security clearance to play with those machines. You can do weather simulations. Those really involve this kind of computation.
But for stuff like that, chances are you're going to be hitting memory a lot, and you're going to be taking...
But memory doesn't cost my process to block, and whether I take page faults is a question of how big my wallet is.
Didn't you say the other day that your that the cache, it doesn't make sense to make a cache bigger than a certain size? So you
That's a cache. That's got nothing to do with page faults. Page faults happen because I run out of main memory. And the kinds of machines where people do weather simulations or bomb simulations or market simulations, these kinds of big compute-intensive jobs, you're looking at machines which have 100,000 processors, each of which has 64 gigabytes of memory attached, or something insane like that. Yeah, I would actually like to have one of those at home, not so much because I want to do the processing, but because it would do wonders for my human build. Okay. The big problem with those machines is heat dissipation. It turns out, imagine getting 100,000 60-watt light bulbs, right? Okay. We'll do them in clusters of five, because it turns out these things are about 300 watts a processor. Right? So we're going to get 100,000 clusters of five light bulbs. We're going to bring in enough power. We're going to put them all in this room. In fact, we're going to put them in a space that's roughly from here to the third row on this half of the room. We're going to turn them all on. Your challenge is not to melt down the building. No shit, this is a serious problem. Right. Also, not to lose any of the light bulbs to heat. Okay, so I can go around. So the quanta actually turns out mostly does not, in practice, govern what processes do on modern machines. Because most processes spend a lot of time waiting. The quanta governs the fact that those exceptional processes that either go astray, they do an infinite loop, they do a lot of computing for some reason, those rare cases, that they don't get in the way of processes that are trying to provide interactive service. Good. So there's a state diagram that we need to know about. And the state diagram describes what's the evolution in the lifetime of a process. Okay? And the simple version of the state diagram is a process can be running, meaning it's on a CPU, actually executing instructions. Process can block. It has done something that has caused it to wait intentionally, on purpose, generally voluntarily. And for our purposes, a page fault is considered voluntary. If you didn't want the page fault, you shouldn't have executed that load instruction. It's part of the contract of the load instruction that they block.
and you're waiting on main memory, and you're still waiting. Is it blocked?
No. That happens at the electrical level. The operating system is not involved in the main memory loop. There aren't enough cycles involved for it to be worthwhile to preempt you for that. Although, as main memory gets further and further away, and that tin can gets cheaper, and the string gets thinner between you and main memory, it's an interesting question whether we should preempt you. And there's now work going on in processors that are called multi-threaded processors that do, in fact, internally preempt you. And that's a topic for an advanced computer architecture course. All right, so you block when you do certain kinds of system calls, right, that you voluntarily wait as a consequence of doing those system calls. Whatever it was you're waiting for, hopefully eventually it happens. Either it happens or you get an error. In either way, that is a conclusion to the wait. It's time to tell you what the result was. Okay, let me take out syscalls. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write here sleep. Sleep is the name of a Unix kernel routine. So when you block, you don't just block randomly. You block on a queue. Your process goes onto that queue. It gets linked into that queue. And so when you want to block, what you want to say is, hey, I would like to block on a particular queue. The queue is the argument to the sleep call. What's really going on is behind your back, the operating system is doing something, and at the conclusion of that operation, it will wake up everybody on that sleep queue. Right, so the queue provides the point of rendezvous. So, for example, you do a read operation, the operating system needs to go get a page, it gets down to the file system, at some point the file system says, I need to initiate an I.O. One, let me go get the structure that will describe an I.O. Strictly speaking, this isn't done in the file system, it's done in the buffer cache, but we're not there yet. Let me get a data structure that's the data structure used to describe an I.O. request. That data structure includes a queue. And I'll fill it in so that I can turn to a disk drive and says, hey, here's what I want. And the requesting process will go onto that queue in that I.O. request structure. I am simplifying the story considerably. And I turn to the disk driver and I say, here's an I.O. request. Put it on your list of pending I.O. requests. When it's done, wake up everybody on this here queue that's attached to this I.O. request structure. So you go from block to ready as a consequence of a wake up on the queue. Ready means you would run if only we would have the decency to give you a processor. So you go from ready to running as a consequence of the scheduler making a decision that's sometimes referred to as a run-in decision. It decides that you're next. You're the lucky winner. Your lottery ticket just got punched. And you'll go from running to ready as a consequence of something that's called preemption. That's what happens when your quota runs out. You would happily still run instructions, and we've decided that you won't run them just now. That's preemption.
Does suspension fit in there somewhere? Like a user suspends a process?
Okay. Yes, but it's not a process state in this sense. So what happens when you say control Z in Unix is a signal gets sent to your process. I think it's, say, T-stop. Your process actually has a handler, conceptually it has a handler, most typically the handler it has is sort of by implication, because there's a default handler implemented by the operating system. But the effect of that default handler, the way to think about it is that your process voluntarily goes on a wait queue that's associated with your kernel state, or with your session, depending on the implementation. And you become blocked, the process that stops becomes blocked on that wait queue. And there's a little more to the story. But so suspension is a higher level notion that's built on top of this thing. There are processes that remain blocked for a hugely long time. Login is a good example. There are two modes for login, right? One, login comes up to a terminal, you're there typing away, you log in. There are three modes for login. Number two, login comes up to a terminal, you've gone for coffee, nothing happens. Coffee turns into lunch, lunch turns into a date, you know, the date turns into something more extended than a date. 5 days later, you come back to the terminal. All this time, login has been patiently waiting for your next keystroke.
But if the cursor is blinking, is the program...
That's not done by login. That's done by the terminal. Okay. Nice try. There is a certain point where most operating systems say, look, you know, after the thing has been blocked for a week, the chances are really good it's going to be blocked for 2 weeks. And we shouldn't keep it in memory. We can always get it back later. At that point, we'll take the whole process out of memory. It will remain blocked. So, you know what? This transition isn't correct. I'm sorry. No, I'm going to take this out. Your book and the handouts would have you believe that there's a set of transitions that are associated with swapping, long-term blockage. This is incorrect. Let me explain why this is incorrect. Suppose that I take your entire process and I move it out of memory. It hasn't run for a week. I don't think it's going to run anytime soon. I don't want to spend memory and resources on it when I could be getting that weather simulation done. So I'm going to put it out to the swap area. I'll remember where I put it so I can get it back later. What am I actually going to take out? Well, I'm going to take out your data. I may deconstruct parts of your address space. There are parts I can rebuild. So anything that I can regenerate, I'm going to throw out. Anything I have to write down, I'm going to write down. Contrary to what the informal terminology says, the informal terminology says we're going to swap your process to disk. That's the one thing that doesn't actually happen. Your process stays in memory. Well, the state associated with your process goes to disk. But somebody has to stay on that queue to get woke up later. If we actually take the process out and put it on the disk, where's the queue pointer going to go? This process is in the linked list. That linked list is the only way this process is going to get woken up. If we take it off the linked list, this process is now asleep forever. We have a term for that. It's called euthanasia. And while that's politically acceptable in operating systems, it's not something we want to do to the login program. So the process itself, that data structure, actually stays. What we do is take everything else out. So if a process has been asleep for a long time, it does occupy a little bit of kernel memory in order that it can stay on that queue. With more cleverness, we could, in fact, find a way even to get the process out. There are other structures we could use on the queue that would let us do that. As far as I know, the only OSs that are even looking at those structures are the ones that we're building here in Hopper. Now, there's actually a data structure corresponding to the process. This data structure is known as the process table. So when your operating system starts up, it allocates an array of these things. And when you do the PS command, PSAUX, what's happening inside the kernel is the kernel is actually iterating over the process table to show you what's going on. Or better still, if you do on Linux, you do an ls of slash proc, you see there are a bunch of files that have numbers. Those correspond to process numbers. It turns out those numbers are not indexes in the table. Every time you create a new process, a new number gets assigned. But the way the slash proc file system was able to tell you what the numbers were, it iterated over the process table, and for each table entry that was currently being used, it said, oh, what's the process ID of that? Which is that number. I bounced around a bunch of couple of things, so I want to pause here for questions. Yeah.
So you're running like an application that's everything's running in like users. You're running user code, right? So like what gets the OS running with the Quanta?
Okay. Remember I talked about interrupt lines? Right? Somebody tugs on a pin and says, I need your attention. The clock has such a pin. So before the OS starts you in motion, there are two designs here. There's the historical design and the write design. The historical design is you set up a periodic timer. Okay? And you say, I want the clock to whack me over the head every so often. And in legacy Unix, every so often was 1 hertz, 1/60th of a second. Nowadays, the value of hertz seems to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which is sort of interesting since the people who do physical constants have not been informed. So you would just set up a periodic interrupt. You would use that periodic interrupt to bump a counter somewhere, and then the counter would actually act as your preemption timer. And so before you would dispatch the process, you would say, and when the counter, I know what the counter value is now, the counter is going to increment at the hertz rate. When the counter hits this other point, it's time to stop. And so what's happening is I'm going to get an interrupt from the periodic counter, and I'm going to piggyback on top of that interrupt to notice that it's time to preempt this guy.
Is the counter done on the CPU, or is it done on specialized hardware?
Depends on which generation of machine we're talking about. On the legacy PCs, it was done in outboard hardware, actually on the CMOS NVRAM chip. Later, there were performance monitoring counters that could be used to do a down counter on the chip itself, and you could get a count out of the processor. After that, somebody invented power management, and then they discovered that the counter actually would slow down and speed up when the processor clock slowed down and sped up. So then somebody said, oh crap, that counter shot, we need another counter. We'll put it on the interrupt controller, which is actually on the same plastic carrier, but originally wasn't on the same chip, now it is. That counter actually continues to run at the officially stated rate, even when your processor steps down its frequency timer. Except in one particular implementation, depending on where this feature turns out to be broken, they just forgot to step down. So the answer is yes. There are lots of options. All bad. Now, unless you have a really important need to get bonked over the head 60 times a second, this is a really stupid way to do it better. Because the cost of getting bonked over the head is high and rising. The smarter thing to do is say, oh, I'm about to dispatch this process. How much time do I want to give it? Good. Tell the clock to whack me over the head when that much time has gone by. I don't need to know all of these other timing events that I frankly don't give a damn about. And the trade-off here is to figure out which one's more expensive. Updating the timer hardware all the time, it turns out the timer hardware interface is usually pretty slow, or taking these extra jobs. And there isn't really a general consensus about what the right answer is. Most of the serious real-time operating systems, they update the timer interrupt on every dispatch. But either technique will work. The first technique, where you have a periodic timer and then you have a soft timer, it's called soft timer. Yeah? Okay. All right, let me close with one thought. What's the catch with round robin. What's, how does it decide what's more important than something else? I got 30 processes that want to run, right? Does round robin cause any of them to be viewed as more important than any others? Are all 30 of those processes of the same level of importance to you? Well, they might be, but probably not. Are there some events where we might say, hey, if this event happens, I'd really like to run this process quickly? This might be a good process to run next under certain conditions. If I've just killed the process, and I need it to know this, but it's done, this is a good process to run next. Why? Because I want to free up the resource. This statement that I've just made ignores concerns of serious real-time scheduling. We're still here talking about ad hoc scheduling. Alright. So, the next move, and we'll start with this tomorrow, is going to be the interesting notion of priority. And there are two kinds of priority, static and dynamic. So static says, if one thing has a higher static priority than the other, it's strictly more important to run the higher priority thing. You run the highest priority candidate, period. And that may mean that the lower priority candidate starves. And that's okay, because that's what it means to be a static system. Dynamic is a scheme where you say, starving is socially unacceptable. I actually do want those unimportant processes to run a little bit, and what I will do is I will tinker with the system. And I will slowly escalate them a little bit, and eventually they'll get to run. And then immediately after they get to run, they'll go back to their static priority, and I'll just start escalating them again. So these processes won't actually starve, they'll just be really, really emaciated. I got to find a better set of metaphors here. All right, we'll start in on this tomorrow.